This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, your host, hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices episode 99A was recorded on January 4th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Macro Voices regular episode 99 included our weekly market wrap in addition to the final segment in the year-end special, Anatomy of the U.S. Dollar Endgame, featuring Jeff Snyder, Luke Groman, and Mark Yusko. For the benefit of listeners tuning in after the fact, we've edited the market wrap out to provide you with just the final segment in the Dollar Endgame series. Be sure to stay tuned after the final installment of Dollar Endgame, though, as Patrick Ceresna and I will be back in our postgame segment to discuss our own reactions to the series. So let's pick up right where we left off at the end of episode 98. We were in the process of discussing our conclusions from the five-part series, and we had just finished discussing the social implications of the U.S. dollar losing its hegemony over the global financial system. Let's continue now right where we left off. My next question is what signposts we should be monitoring along the way to gauge how this dollar endgame is progressing. Now, to illustrate my point, I'll start with a couple of my own. First one, I'm watching the open interest, or I should say I will be watching the open interest when this new yuan-denominated crude oil contract starts trading. To my thinking, if this thing gets traction, and a year from now we're talking about how the Brent contract lost a considerable part of its market share to the new yuan contract for trading oil, okay, that tells me this thing is on like Donkey Kong. It's accelerating, and it's time to really think about the end is nigh for the dollar. On the other hand, if this turns out to just be a purely symbolic gesture, where we say, okay, well, theoretically, it's possible to trade oil in yuan, but nobody really ever does. Okay, that tells me that we're still in the buildup phase. It's still an important symbolic gesture, but it's just a symbolic gesture. Another major signpost that I'm going to be watching for is a decoupling of the usual relationship between interest rate differentials and the dollar index. In other words, if treasury yields are going up at the same time that the dollar index is going down, things are getting serious, because that means, you know, as long as there's rising treasury yields and that continues to attract international capital flows into the U.S., the system is basically working the way it used to. If it breaks down to where rising relative, and I say relative to other sovereigns around the world, the U.S. is paying better treasury yields than anybody else, and that's not attracting international capital flows into U.S. treasuries and into the dollar, that tells me the end game is on. Now, those are just two examples. What are the signposts that you guys think we should be watching for to gauge how this story is unfolding, and particularly what signposts tell us that, okay, this thing's really on now. It's not just a buildup. It's really happening. Luke, why don't we start with yours? Because I think you've got quite a bit of research on this point.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Eric. You know, look, I think key signposts, I think if global central banks were to stop sterilizing U.S. deficits by stockpiling FX reserves for the first time in 70 years, I think that would be a signpost. And that's a signpost that factually has happened over three years ago, 3Q14. I think once that happens, I think I would be looking for U.S. deficits to begin rising as a percent of GDP for the first time since the recession, because that has been a fail-proof 100% of the time indicator of either a coming recession or coming U.S. dollar devaluation over the last 50 years. And that began in 3Q16. I totally 100% agree with your point that if I started seeing the dollar down despite rates up and beneficial rate differentials in the U.S., look, that's a classic emerging market problem, right? Where the currency is going down and rates are going up. That's what we were talking about with the pigs. That's what we were talking about with Argentina, et cetera, et cetera. Guess what's happened in the U.S. this year? Dollars down, rates are up despite beneficial rate differentials. I think you would start to see what you typically see in these emerging markets, which is a sharp rise in local currency terms of risk assets, regardless of fundamentals, regardless of valuations. Guess what's happened to U.S. stock markets this year? Guess what's happened to Bitcoin this year? Guess what's happened to artwork this year? Guess what's happened to classic cars, real estate, et cetera? It's happening. I think we are in the very late innings. And I think, you know, to your point earlier, Eric, I think because like the IMF former chief economist said almost 10 years ago, if you take the name off the masthead of what country it is and you described it 10 years ago, you'd say, oh my gosh, this is a disaster. And the only thing that kind of kept it was that the fact that we were the US and global central banks were stockpiling our debt as their reserve assets. And we're now over 3 years into them not doing that anymore. I think we're a lot further along in this process. What is the final trigger? I think that goes to that Jeff's point. It's unpredictable. We don't know. I mean, look, we could come out in 10 days, debt ceiling, you know, December 8th, everyone seems to have forgotten about that. And the U.S. could say, yep, we're not paying it. Or you know, we're getting rid of it altogether. We're just going to print it all from now on and we'll spend whatever we need to spend. You never know. Could that happen? It absolutely could happen. You know, Trump reached across the aisle a couple months ago saying, hey, why do we even need a debt ceiling? Let's just spend. You know, it could be something, some sort of binary political announcement. It could be some sort of war or geopolitical problem. It could be the yuan-denominated oil contract gaining traction. I mean, it's a matter of national security for China to move in that direction. So there's a lot of potential triggers, but to me, it keeps pointing to the same thing, almost like those Venezuelan credit default swaps. Like they were at their lows when people were turning to prostitution for food and starving to death. And, you know, 4 to 5 months later, they were up 5X. And I think there's something very similar here going on where we are well into this process. A lot of the symptoms are there. Just people are not sort of accounting for them properly because it's the USA instead of Argentina on the masthead.
Mark Yusko, what signposts are you watching for?
Yeah, I agree on a number of the signposts. I do think the asset values is one to really watch. You know, I had this kind of epiphany the other day. You know, Grant Williams, who's a good friend and Twitter buddy, spoke at a conference I was at and, you know, showed a number of things that all of us look at to say, oh, you know, stock markets are incredibly overvalued. Things like price to sales ratios and PE ratios and CAPE ratios and, you know, all the things that we have been classically taught tell us that things are toppy. And then he put up a chart that really I'm struggling with for the last week. Wrote about it in my letter. I'm talking about it tomorrow in our Around the World conversation. And it was the index, the S&P 500 in gold, which is actually materially lower than 2007 and materially lower than 2000. And so when I think about what has happened in terms of a nominal inflation of assets, kind of last ditch effort to fill the government coffers. You know, I read an amazing stat, and I don't know if it's right or wrong. And, you know, you never know what's right these days around government, but he said that the top half of taxpayers pay 97.3% of taxes, which is just a frightening stat. And I think that's, you know, figures lie and liars figure because the bottom half actually don't pay any, but he did say taxpayers. So I assume that excluded the people who don't pay taxes, but maybe not. But anyway, I think what I am looking at more now is these nominal increases. I mean, when single pieces of artwork go for $450 million, you have to wonder that person who made that purchase, if it's who we believe it to be rumored, that person's a really intelligent human being, which is proven by the amount of wealth they've been able to create over the past 20 years. Why would a really intelligent human being do that? That just sends chills up my spine, actually. So other things I look at are this issue you brought up, Eric, about the difference between treasuries and equities. You know, if equities were to start to go down, if there start to be a recession and kind of a loss of confidence in the U.S. financial system and treasuries weren't the safe haven asset that people flock to, which they have been for the last 40 years, that would be a signpost to really pay attention to. Now, I'm actually not in that group. I'm contrarian on this one. I think the lows in interest rates are ahead of us, not behind us. I do think at least in the short run, we are still going to be that safe haven, that risk-free asset. And I think we're about 6 or 7 years right around that timing of that 2022, 2023 timeframe for the real crisis in America. But those are things that I'll certainly be watching. And then finally is maybe the most logical or rational kind of the Occam's razor is what's the currency itself doing? You know, are people running away from it or are people flooding toward it? Right now, I seem to see people running away from the dollar. So there's signposts all over the place from individual crosses to just the demand for dollars for trade. I think all those signs are pointing to a weaker currency and a weaker U.S. and a weaker environment. The statistic that nobody pays attention to is kind of interesting is we have the lowest growth rate of U.S. GDP in the history of recorded GDP since we started keeping track 100 and something years ago. So 2010 to 2017 is the lowest rate of growth in our history as a country. So there's probably a reason for that. It probably doesn't bode well for the future. And it is a signpost that I think we should be paying very significant attention to.
Jeff Snyder, what signposts do you watch for along the way?
You know, I'm watching the same things all you guys are, obviously, because, you know, those are the important things that matter. I want to actually take it in another direction because I think we're actually in a race. We're in a race toward some of the worst consequences that you described, Eric, and I think those are very real. And the race is between the system that just continues on as it is. Again, you know, we're 10 years into this thing, and remarkably, the Eurodollar system limps along as badly as it has been. And so I think the other side of that is there's a possibility that people actually wake up and find that this is a huge problem and then actually do something about it. And there's a couple of signposts that we've already seen that are essentially positive. There was one last year where the Bank for International Settlements wrote this. I forget who the author was offhand. I'd have to look it up. But they actually wrote a paper where they talked about the breakdown in covered interest parity, which is a huge deal, especially for mainstream economics, because covered interest parity is one of the best established principles in orthodox economic treatment of currencies and finance. What it essentially says is all of these things that we piece together as this dollar shortage is a lack of covered interest parity, the inability of the banking system and the monetary system to enforce arbitrage and to keep things into certain bounds. And the fact that, you know, here we had the BIS talking about the breakdown of covered interest parity was a big sign that, hey, they're starting to get the idea that there's something out there that doesn't work. And not only that there's something out there that doesn't work, that maybe we find out that it's the monetary system that doesn't work. And it wasn't just that. I mean, there's been quite a few those kinds of things, academic papers, official papers where monetary authorities, central bankers or whatnot, more than just the staffs are saying that there is something wrong here that we previously we didn't think anything was wrong, but maybe there is something there. You could talk about Federal Reserve in the last year starting to talk about inflation. All the models said that they would get their 2% inflation long before now. And the fact that the CPI and the PCE deflator in particular don't hit 2% and can't hit 2% even after doing all of the trillions in QE is forcing some economists and some Federal Reserve members, FOMC members, to actually start to look at some of their most basic assumptions about what has gone on in the last 10 years and even longer. You know, they talk about the unemployment rate. You know, there's something wrong with the unemployment rate because why hasn't inflation spiked at this particular point? And I'll give you another example. Even today, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, the title of which was A Decade After the Crisis, King Dollar is the World's Tyrant. It's the same thing is, you know, the mainstream media, the Wall Street Journal, which is one of the most orthodox institutions, is starting to get the idea that there is a dollar problem. And the dollar problem is a significant explanatory variable in everything that has taken place up to and including the political and social upheaval that we've talked about recently. So, you know, in my mind, it's a race between these positive things, the idea that maybe somebody will finally wake up and look to solve the issue before the worst of the worst happens, and the fact that we are on a trajectory toward those worst of the worst problems. So it's which one works out first? Do we get to the somebody putting together the right kinds of answers at the right kind of time, which would involve significant international cooperation? Or do they just stay in denial forever and just let this whole thing fall and crash and reset?
Let's move on now to which investment assets are going to be the best and worst performers through this transition. There's no doubt in my mind that gold is going to be a winner in the end game. The thing I worry about is that so many people are just so gung-ho about gold right now. I fear that, as Jeff has described, the dollar shortage could cause gold to underperform at least for the next couple of years if the dollar appreciates against other currencies, including gold, as part of a last hurrah safety trade effect before it eventually begins to lose value. But the bigger concern that I have about gold is I think it's very likely to be the target of a windfall profit tax when that period of taxing the rich punitively that I spoke of earlier comes to pass. Now, taxing the rich, I predict, won't be limited to people who are actually rich. Anything that is perceived to be an asset of rich people is going to be taxed punitively. And I fear that gold is going to be at the top of that list, regardless of the true degree of wealth of the people holding it. Other hard assets, such as real estate in particular, I think are much less likely to be subject to a windfall profits tax because they're so much more widely held than gold is. So I think, you know, from a monetary theory standpoint, gold should be the big winner, but I have some real reservations about how it might be treated. In the end game, though, I think the really big loser is going to be bonds, both corporates and treasuries. I mean, let's face it, the problem we have in this world is just way too much debt that cannot be serviced and paid back in real terms. And I don't think that it's an easy trade by any stretch of the imagination. I think by far the most likely course of events is that there will be one last major flight to safety trade into U.S. treasuries, leading to a final blow-off top in prices, meaning a bottom in yields, which could be considerably lower than the 1.36 or whatever the low print has been so far in the 10-year yield. Like any other bubble that ends with a blow-off, though, knowing when that's happening and when it's time to go short is extremely difficult. I also see serious risks in short-selling strategies because I think they're likely to be labeled as unpatriotic in the endgame. Politicians will be desperate to find scapegoats to skirt accountability for their own failures. And so anyone who's so unpatriotic as to bet against America by selling U.S. Treasury paper short, they're going to have a bullseye on their back, regardless of the economic reality of that transaction. It's going to be perceived as an unpatriotic thing. Overall, I think the winning play will be to get out of financial assets and into hard assets. But the picture is muddy. As I said, it's not as simple as buying gold and silver the way so many people want to believe it is. I think it's going to be much more important to think about the coming escalation of the class divide. The rich are going to be taxed punitively. And that, I really think, is going to come down to the people who are perceived to be, quote, the rich, not the real rich. So anybody who's what I call small-time rich guy, that's somebody who has more money than the average Joe in the street, let's say a net worth between $500,000 and $5 million, I think that's the people who are going to be targeted. The truly rich are going to use their power and influence to work around the system and avoid being taxed. But I think that the affluent part of society is going to be taxed punitively. And I think it's going to be very hard to find, you know, a winning financial or trading solution to this problem, because I think that things like gold are likely to be the targets of windfall profits taxes. So that's kind of the way I see things. Mark, what's your take? Where is the place to be in terms of financial and market assets through this transition that we see coming?
Eric, this is where I'm having the cognitive dissonance. Is my brain has been trained to think one way, which is to say that buying overvalued assets is a really bad idea, and buying undervalued assets is a really good idea. As a value guy, that's kind of how I live. But recently, that strategy has not worked. And when I say recently, I mean over a number of years, where really it's been all about buy the most expensive asset because it's going to get more expensive because it's a momentum home. And that's been very frustrating for any of us who try to be more thoughtful about what we buy. In the world in which we are all, you know, envisioning, I think there's a, you know, non-zero probability that the exact opposite strategy of what my brain would normally tell me to do, which would be to get out of, you know, financial assets, particularly U.S. equities, may actually be one of the best performing asset classes over that period. Now, you have to look at it in terms of how does it perform in real terms, if your dollars being destroyed, if your currency is being destroyed while you're really not paying attention, which I think is one of the challenges today in that comment earlier about the average person not being able to afford a car using regular financing. So now you got to finance out to 60 months or 72 months or 84 months. That's distressing. The fact that, you know, I went to lunch the other day with one of my guys up in New York, and granted it was New York, but still it was a hamburger, and the bill was $60, 6-0 for two hamburgers. So there's just something going on that is real and like boiling a frog. People aren't feeling it. They're not paying attention to it because it's just insidious every single day. You know, you go back to Starbucks and they raise the price 3 cents, and then they raise it 3 cents, you know, 2 months later, and they raise it another 3 cents. And pretty soon you're paying $4 for a cup of coffee instead of $3 for a cup of coffee, which is kind of silly anyway, but I do it. So I'm struggling in that my predilection is to say, get real. In fact, I even have a hashtag for it on Twitter, get real, which is to buy real assets. I think your points, Eric, on taxation of safe haven assets or rich people assets. Although it's interesting, gold is clearly used to be a rich person's asset. But I feel like today it's a tinfoil hat wearing asset. It's not the rich people who own gold. It's the crazy people like myself who think that you should be worried about the government confiscation of wealth, and you should be worried about inflation as a wealth tax. So, but I do think that we'll get in there as a windfall profits tax or just a plain old devaluation like they did in the 30s. I also think you gotta look at what's going on in the Bitcoin world. You know, like we could do a whole show on Bitcoin, obviously, and what's going on there. And is that really the first wave of this devolution of our currency and the value of our currency, watching, you know, Bitcoin go from a couple hundred dollars to almost $10,000 today? Just extraordinary movement. So I'm kind of at a little bit of a loss. My gut says I want to own emerging market assets and in equities because that's where the growth is going to be. My gut says I don't want to own US assets because they're really highly overvalued. I don't really want to own other developed market assets like Europe. Although as I say that, as it's coming out of my mouth, I do like what's going on in Japan. And as they move to what I think is going to be the beginning of a whole, I'm going to open up a huge can of worms here in that I think Japan is rapidly moving toward a debt jubilee where they're going to solve part of this challenge, which is what everyone thinks is the intractable problem of having too much debt to GDP. I think they've just slowly and carefully been issuing currency, buying up those bonds into the Bank of Japan. And at some point, they're going to own them all. And then they're just going to cancel them and just get rid of it. So whole nother topic for another day again. I want to own diversifying assets. I want to own real assets. But I fear, particularly in the short run, that, and I wrote my whole quarterly letter about this, as Yogi Berra said, it ain't over till it's over. And that this bubble, particularly in U.S. financial assets, is going to run longer than normal people would. When I say normal, meaning people who rely on their brain as opposed to momentum, I think it's going to go further than we think.
Jeff Snyder, what's your take? What do you want to own as we go through this transition?
I'm with Mark here. I think you have to have a realistic assessment of where we are, and you want to get real. I think you want to have real assets, whether it be real estate, commodities, gold, whatever. You have to have a significant allocation to real type assets. But more than that, there's more than one way to do this. And I think no matter which way you decide to do it that's right for you, you have to be aware of the risks. And I think in some ways that this is the most difficult time to be an investor because there aren't any real safe haven asset like there had been in the past. You know, you go back 20 years during the dot-com bubble, you could buy a U.S. Treasury yielding almost 6%, and that would be a decent return, a decent, safe, low risk adjusted return. Whereas today you don't have that. And, you know, I'm of the view, like you, Eric, the interest rates are probably going lower before they go higher. But still, you know, there's more than enough risk in the Treasury market that you have to be aware of what you're doing even there. And so it's a challenge to get a risk adjusted return that is actually makes sense for what you're trying to do and what the actual risks are, because we're in a period of tremendous transition. There's no question about it. I think we all agree that something has to change here. Something has to give. And that can be a pretty violent paradigm shift. So it presents a lot of challenges about how you get through that period to get to that point B, which is the happy days. A lot of people end up getting wiped out in these kinds of transitions, which is why I think you want to be careful about how you do it and why you want to be quite favorable towards real assets, because that's where history has shown it's the best place to be in any kind of transition that you really can't predict ahead of time.
Luke Groman, what do you want to own when the shit hits the fan?
You know, I still am very optimistic. I think this is a really, really positive, optimistic thing for pretty much much of the country. I it's interesting, both of you guys use the word real. I have, you know, winners think real in quotation marks. So, you know, look, demographics, debt, entitlements, those three things mean it is a mathematical certainty that Western sovereigns will default in nominal terms unless real rates remain solidly negative. And so I agree that that sets up a really favorable environment historically for gold. And I agree that gold wins, but I think gold will be the absolute last asset to rise in price. It will do nothing like it's done nothing for 5 years. So few people understand the paper gold market is structured in a very similar manner to the subprime CDS market last cycle. You have large supplies of paper gold, just like you had large supplies of subprime CDS able to be created out of thin air, with very little to no underlying capital requirements. And if you remember that moment in The Big Short where Michael Burry was confused because initially he owns these CDS, you know, these insurance policies against falling home prices, and the value of those insurance policies against falling home prices began falling when home prices fell. And it's the same thing this time around, right? Gold prices have fallen after the U.S. got downgraded for the first time ever. They've fallen as U.S. credit worthiness has declined notably, as balance sheets of central banks globally have moved higher. Paper market gold leverage has moved significantly higher since 2013, to the extent you can get some brief glimpses of it since 2013, when you had a run on physical gold that commenced in early 2013. Now, I ultimately think gold will do what Bitcoin has done. And I think it actually is probably pretty powerful. We now have had a monetary asset go from $1,000 to $10,000 in 1 year. And there have been no real negative financial impacts. No zombie apocalypse. We're not sitting in bunkers. The sun is still up and shining. My Cleveland Browns still suck. You know, after Bitcoin, if gold goes from 1,300 to 10,000 in 6 months, in 1 year, investors might just say, I guess that makes sense. I guess, you know, to your point, Eric, on punitive windfall on taxes on gold, you know, my thought has always been and continues to be, why tax it when you can confiscate it from the people of America by sticking a We Buy Gold stand in every mall and out front of every jewelry store in America? You know, U.S. citizens' gold, it's already gone. It was confiscated, sold for dollars, shipped east. And for the wealthy holders of gold, I think, A, they write the laws in this country, sometimes verbatim, and hand it to their sponsored Congress people. And B, you know, if you put a windfall profit tax on gold, look, that gold is going to be put in a suitcase. It's going to be loaded onto a G5 at Teterboro Airport, and it'll be flown to a location nonstop where such windfall taxes don't exist. And so to me, unless you really go to a 1984 type scenario, which I'm optimistic won't happen, I don't think there's a windfall tax coming. My view on that might change if you see a windfall tax proposed on Bitcoin. But in terms of, you know, more broadly, I think the implications are straightforward. If you have to have real negative rates for a long time to keep sovereigns solvent or non-fault, then I think any asset class whose issuance is non-sovereign and non-infinite should, and in fact must, outperform sovereign currency, sovereign debt. And so I think the optimal strategy is really a levered long. Borrow as long as you can at fixed rates. And if you can find a positive, real, positive ROI investment, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think flip side of that is that the real value of debt, and especially sovereign debt, is likely to get crushed and mathematically must be crushed to avoid a much worse outcome.
Finally, I'd like to ask all three of you one last round of questions. All three of you are professional money managers or investment advisors. So let's suppose that I am a prospective client. I'm considering the possibility of hiring each of you to run $1 million for me. I'm going to start with Luke and Mark because my question to both of you is going to be the same, which is, look, I am 100.00% convinced that you two guys are going to be proven right in the end on this stuff. There's no doubt in my mind. But my biggest hesitation about hiring you to run my money is that I think you're probably a bit ahead of the pack. You might be a bit early with your dollar call. And I see a strong chance that Jeff is going to be proven right. And again, his view is not dollar bullish per se. It's just that there's going to be a continuing dollar shortage as a result of the breakdown of the euro-dollar system. And it makes me worry if you guys are so dollar bearish. You know, does that mean I'm at risk of losing money if I invest with you guys? And Jeff has proven right. So, you know, where does that leave us? Why don't we start with Mark?
Yeah, so look, I think it's a very important point. And I was one of the lone wolves, along with Luke and a handful of others, at the beginning of this year that felt the dollar would depreciate. And so that worked out well. And what's interesting is the assets that we thought would benefit from that actually did by and large, but not in the way you would think. What was interesting is oil, for example, which normally goes up when the dollar goes down, actually did the opposite for the first half of the year. Oil went down. That was one of our big surprises, was that oil would fall toward 40 by mid-year and then rally back to 60 by the end of the year. And looks like we're going to be, you know, right on both halves of that. So we were able to play that correctly, even though our view on the dollar going down would have said, just get long oil all year, which would not have been that great a trade. So I think what you have to do is separate the dollar from other types of assets. So if you come to Morgan Creek today, we're going to have a heavy weighting in emerging markets. I think one of the things about emerging markets is it has become less dependent on that dollar trade because they are less dependent on commodities, much more in emerging markets today related to consumption and big opportunities in places like healthcare, technology, consumer, alternative energy, as opposed to traditional commodities. So we've seen that breakdown a little bit of the dollar linkage to emerging markets. So if the dollar were to have a short-term rally, that doesn't mean necessarily that emerging markets are going to get killed, particularly if the earnings continue to come through. And then the last piece of that is we always say the dollar rallying relative to what? Given how cheap emerging market currencies are relative to the dollar, we think it's pretty unlikely that the dollar rallies relative to those. Now, it could rally relative to the euro or the yen, but I just don't see it really rallying against emerging market currencies. So we do favor real assets today. So, you know, we do have a little bit of exposure to gold, which I totally agree with the last comments that it's going to be dead money for a while because of this silly creation of paper gold that comes out of, you know, thin air, which is one of the benefits of Bitcoin being digital gold and having a true fixed supply. So then the last place, and this is something that's harder for the quote unquote average investor, and I feel badly because the SEC defines that. They say if you're not rich, you're not smart, which I think is completely ridiculous. Some of the smartest people I know don't have a lot of money, and some of the wealthiest people I know don't have a lot of sense. Not true universally, but I've seen plenty of wealthy people who are deemed accredited or qualified purchasers do some really unintelligent things with their capital. Whereas I've seen some, you know, pretty average investors that the SEC deems unworthy of investing in private investments or hedge funds do some really intelligent things with their capital. So I like the private markets today, particularly the private markets outside the US, particularly in places like China, where, you know, we're buying into just incredible growth at rock bottom prices because these are our private markets and people have this bias against those particular markets. So look, if the dollar were to have a sharp rally, I do think in the short run, it would harm emerging markets. It would harm, you know, U.S. corporate profits and U.S. equities. And I think it would actually cause some stress in the physical commodity world. So some of the themes that we follow would be damaged. So I guess to that point, I've tweeted a lot about this, that cash is king, and that having more cash than you would otherwise have is a really good investment here. And some of the smartest guys I know, be Seth Klarman or Julian Robertson or George Soros, have 50%+ in cash today because they think it has high option value. So that's another way to deal with this short-term uncertainty so that you have capital to buy the cheap assets that you want to own for the next leg up.
Luke Grohman, same question. As you invest in this world, how do you hedge the possibility that Jeff will be proven right before you're proven right?
There's this great article also actually today in the journal, and it talks about, you know, the title of the article, it's not the leverage, it's the illiquidity that will hurt. And within it is with the quote, with really illiquid assets, there is no market. And so they must mark them to modeled valuations or educated guesses. And it's a talk about how this time around, the percentage of assets and pensions and insurance companies in particular in the article are these more illiquid things. So it's, to me, when I look at the context of what has transpired in 2008, since 2008, of, you know, the euro dollar, hey, what happens if we get a strong dollar spike, a super spike and a sell-off in risk that is really persistent in any way? I think what happens is liquidity will evaporate. I think funds will erect gates. I think everyone will mark the fantasy, and I think no one will lose money. And then I think central banks will bail it all out. And I think nobody thinks this will happen, but it happened in 2008. You had a suspension of short selling. You had a suspension of mark-to-market accounting that, as far as I know, has not been reinstated. In 08, it took authorities a year to respond because they didn't understand the severity of the problem, to Jeff's point, of that it was the euro-dollar market that was more important beginning in 07 that broke down, and not sort of the classical things they were all focused on. And I think they, whether they completely understand it, they certainly understand it a lot more. You've seen money market fund gating rules were approved 3 years ago. You know, Jim Rickards, I thought, to me, in his latest book, Road to Ruin, opened with a fascinating point, which was he was talking with an unnamed high-level exec at BlackRock. And that person said that in fall of 2014, the U.S. government approached BlackRock about instituting selling bans, not short selling bans in the next crisis, the U.S. government. You know, we've seen the market reaction to the last several crises getting serially shorter, culminating in the last one, which lasted 6 hours after election night. And so all of this is, you know, what we're describing is taking place in the context of a world where any sustained sell-off in risk assets will quickly pose an acute risk of a U.S. government nominal default and then, you know, nominal default of other Western governments. And so to me, the question is less how do I hedge it and more, I think, an asset or capital weighted strategy of do you really think you'll be able to perfectly trade the round trip risk off dollar spike flight into treasuries and then run to the other side of the boat, get back out of treasuries, you know, back into risk assets. And I think at the $1 million size you're hypothetically, you know, given to each of us, I think you'd probably be able to. You'd have to be very nimble, but I think you could do it. At the $100 million size, probably. At the $1 billion size, 10 billion size or larger, I don't think so. And at the 100 billion size, there's no way, in my opinion. And so to me, we've seen all these things. You saw it again in early 2016. It was highlighted. I thought it was one of the best pieces Zero Hedge ever did. It highlighted that, in essence, the Dallas Fed was telling banks to stop marking to market the shale stuff. And the shale names all bottomed that day. And it was never explicitly said that way, but they later went back and they highlighted exactly the meeting. The meeting took place. They were trying to, I think people are wildly underweighting the degree to which they'll change the rules and the speed at which they'll change them this time around. So I guess that's probably how I would say I really don't lose a ton of sleep at this point, because I just think, you know, nobody's got a bigger DVO1, dollar value of a basis point risk, than the U.S. government.
Jeff Snyder, same question turned around is essentially, I'm really very persuaded by your argument that this dollar shortage is continuing. I think it probably is bullish for the U.S. dollar against other currencies in the short run. But I'm also convinced that in the end game, Mark and Luke have got this figured out. So how do you invest around this? Is there a signal that you watch for when you change gears? What do you do in terms of how you approach your investment strategy?
Well, the way we want to approach our investment strategy is with Luke and Mark in mind. We want to make sure that we have our eyes on what the endpoint here is, or what we think the perhaps the most likely endpoint is, so that we don't want to get caught like Luke is talking about, where you're stuck on one side of the trade and you want to get to the other. And so we try to invest so that we can anticipate how this might all work out, so that it's consistent with what we find today. And it's not an easy task, and that's why I think we do a lot of our allocation toward real assets, because those are the things that are going to perform the best relatively over both kinds of periods. And I'm talking about the short run as well as with our eyes on the end game here. And so I think that's the challenge, is to make sure that you understand the risks of everything that you're doing, so that you can be as consistent as possible from A to B. At point B is where you might want to change completely, reorient your investment philosophy to a much better and happier day. But it's getting from A to B that you need to worry about today. And so I think, you know, from our perspective, it's not necessarily about do one thing or do another. It's about how can you be consistent, knowing that you don't really know how this is going to play out, but you have an idea of where we're going in the long run, which is a sort of a paradigm shift.
Finally, before we close, I'd like to ask all three of you to share with our listeners what you do for a living. Mark runs a hedge fund. Jeff and Luke are both investment advisors. What do your companies offer to investors? Who are your clients? And how can our interested listeners both find out more about you, follow your work, follow your writings, but also learn more about what offerings your companies have to offer? Why don't we start this time with Luke?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. FFTT, or Forest for the Trees, is a macroeconomic thematic research firm, provides unique research services for institutional and high net worth investors. And what we do is aggregate large amounts of data from disparate publicly available information in an unconventional manner. We're just trying to identify developing economic bottlenecks because our 24 years of experience on the street suggests that excess returns accrue to those sectors set to benefit from or be hurt by economic bottlenecks. And you can find out more information about FFTT, including a couple of samples, on our website, which is FFTT, FrankFrankTomTom-LLC.com. And I also have a pretty active Twitter feed at Luke Groman, LukeGromen.
Mark Yusko, tell us about the fund you manage for Morgan Creek.
Yep. So, you know, again, because of some SEC rules and regulations, I can't talk too much specifically about the funds, but we do run a couple of different funds, one focused on global long short equity, one focused on emerging markets, also long short, but more long biased. We run a number of private markets funds, global as well as some focused ones like the one in China. And also as our registered investment advisor, helping some wealthy families with essentially an outsourced CIO model. So you can find out more about us, and we're happy to contact people after they contact us at Morgan Creek Cap, CAP.com. And then I also am active on Twitter. My wife would say overly active on Twitter. At Mark Yusko, MarkYusko, and I look forward to engaging with anybody who would like more information.
Jeff Snyder, tell us all about Alhambra Investments, please.
Well, like the fortress in southern Spain that we're named after, the Alhambra endured centuries of political and economic turmoil, and that's kind of where how we approach investing, is that we're trying to recognize the situation that we're in and create investment strategies and portfolio strategies that are designed to allow people success, knowing the risks and the period of time that we're actually trying to invest within. We try to use our in-depth research of not just euro dollars, but specific sectors to be able to do that, because, you know, we have to be aware of what kind of emerging risks, you know, the unknown unknowns, as well as the known unknowns that could threaten your portfolio. Our goal here is to provide retail investors, you know, not specifically high net worth individuals, but any kind of retail investors as a registered investment advisor, how we can use our research best to design portfolio strategies that accomplish the goals with a realistic assessment of the conditions that we're in mind. And you can find us at AlhambraPartners.com. And I do lots of writing and research that's available throughout the internet and syndicated in lots of different places.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
You know, Eric, the five-part series has now come to an end. What a great series. Just so much content. So great that we got the three of them together and with you and have that great conversation about understanding how, you know, the currency world is going to change in the upcoming decades. Nonetheless, what was your reaction to the whole series?
Well, when I listened to it, my immediate reaction was, crap, how are we ever going to top that? So I guess we'll have to set our our sights higher, because I thought it was excellent. I really want to thank our guests, though, and explain to our listeners, you know, the normal burden that we place on a Macro Voices interview guest is 45 minutes of their time. They usually know what they want to say. Most of them already have materials prepared ahead of time. We take up 45 minutes of their time. All three of these guys prepared custom slide decks just for this. We originally asked them for 2 hours of their time. When it suddenly became clear that it was going to take much longer than that, they all just had a fantastic attitude and said, hey, let's just do whatever it takes. We'll rearrange our schedules. We ended up scheduling several additional recording sessions beyond the plan. Everybody was just a trooper and delivered, I think, fantastic content. Please, people, if you appreciated this series, let our guests know how much you appreciated it, because they really did go beyond the call of duty on this one. They're all on Twitter, and I'm sure they would all appreciate a thank you note from any listeners who enjoyed the series.
All right. Well, let's move on and actually talk about it, because, you know, I was trying to reflect upon what was talked about during the series. And obviously, you know, one of the big questions you asked here in this last part was, how do you invest in this environment? You know, what are the considerations for how do you build a portfolio to deal with this idea of the U.S. dollar endgame and the U.S. losing that role? And one of the things that I kind of picked up on in there, obviously, the theme came up of owning real assets, this idea of real estate, gold, all these different things. And that's sort of a kind of, I'm reflecting on that. And it's like, that really, to me, is not necessarily a US dollar endgame scenario. That's really investments that work because we're in a fiat currency system. Like, if you look back, this has been a story that's been working since 1971, right? When Nixon closed the gold window, the fiat currency system was really established. We had a massive devaluation of the purchasing value of all global currencies. The US dollar lost over 90% of its purchasing value in those 40 years. So anyone owning real estate, anyone owning gold has made thousands of percent return over that time frame, because that's owning real assets is something that works in this kind of currency environment. So, you know, the idea that the US dollar endgame requires us to own more real assets, I just think that real assets are going to continue to work because we're in a system where money is being created through credit. It's just being pumped into the system. The purchasing value of our money continuously is eroded, and owning real assets retains that. And that's, I thought it was really interesting. But, you know, I was hoping that there would be something more we'd get out of it in terms of, you know, what else is there that we can do to try to profit from this kind of transition? What was your take on that?
Well, I agree with what you said about real assets have been a good idea since the fiat system came into existence after 1971 with the gold window and Bretton Woods and so forth. But I think that gets more true in this environment as the U.S. dollar loses its reserve currency status, as the petrodollar system breaks down, if there is any traction. We'll find out starting January 18th. It'll be very interesting to see if this Shanghai futures contract trading crude oil gets any direction. But as far as where, you know, what I got out of the series, I think the biggest thing, and this is a change that's really happened before the series, but was really driven home by the series for me. If I go back a year, I had a secular view which was bullish on the U.S. dollar. And the reason that I had that view is because I do think that there has not been a viable alternative to the dollar as a global reserve asset for central banks. And until there is, I think the safety trade goes into the U.S. dollar. It's basically that there's going to be more economic crisis problems in the world. European sovereigns don't look clean. JGBs are not the place you want to go. As much as it is definitely a dirty shirt, it's the cleanest dirty shirt argument, I think U.S. treasuries will benefit in a crisis. And I guess the view that I've come around to, I still think those arguments all make lots of sense, but this is so complicated and so complex with so many moving parts. I think this really is a story where you have to say, yeah, all of those things are interesting. I want to understand and continue to develop my ideas along those lines, but I also really want to dig into understanding Luke Roman's ideas and Mark Yusko's ideas and Jeff Snyder's ideas, not because any one of them is capable of predicting or forecasting which way the dollar goes, but rather I'm going to let the market tell me what the trend is. I'm going to, you know, follow the tape and not try to predict it. And what I'll try to do is use the information that I glean from these various different bits of analysis to understand if the dollar starts to decline dramatically against other currencies. Well, I'll look at if it's declining against other currencies. Is it also declining against gold? Is it declining against other real assets? You know, and I'll try to make sense of it based on a number of different theses that are integrated from different viewpoints. I don't think it's possible. I think this is too complex of a system for anybody to predict what's going to happen. What you can do is educate yourself about it so that as things start to happen in the markets, you're able to interpret what's driving them and why. If I can get that far, I'll be happy.
All right. Well, you know what? The one point I'd like to kind of make, and Mark Yusko touched on it in this episode, you know, if I was to put myself in a situation as a retail listener and I look at the title of the series, you know, The Anatomy of the U.S. Dollar Endgame, the natural conclusion just from the title alone is this idea that the U.S. dollar is going to come crashing down. And so my first natural response, if I was looking at it like as a retail investor, would be, well, that means I should own other currencies. I should own euros. I should own yen. I should own Canadian dollar and renminbis and everything like this. But that's not really the takeaway here. I mean, in the end, owning these other currencies is not really going to be as easy of a trade. You know, each of these countries has their own problems. And while the U.S. is going to lose its status as the global reserve currency over time, you know, it's not going to solve the structural flaws and problems that all these other countries have. Like, it's not like, at least in my humble opinion, like that the euro is suddenly miraculously going to shoot up to 160 again in a period of negative interest rates and one of the most asymmetrically lopsided trades in German bonds with these negative yields. It's like, how is money flow going into that currency? Like, it's not to me a simple thing of, well, let's go long euros, short US dollars, because the end game is here. I think that the way that you have to trade this and play it out is going to be far more muddled in terms of how it plays out than simply just the US dollar of dropping.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I guess I see your argument. I hope that the content of the series overcame any impression somebody might have had based on the title, because I think of this not as a prediction what the dollar is going to do in the next 6 months. I think of it as more of a prediction that the important thing to pay attention to probably for the next 15 to 20 years is going to be how this dollar endgame story plays out. We are in the dollar endgame. It's going to happen over a period of decades, not a period of weeks. And I think that most people are not aware of the fact that what's going on is a very slow process of the dollar losing hegemony. It basically had a monopoly. The U.S. dollar was it. The whole financial system, global financial system, was based on and designed around and centered on the U.S. dollar. And that was the name of the game, baby. That's it. It's changing, and it's changing very slowly, so slowly that a lot of people don't realize that it's changing, but it is. And the most important thing, I think, to look at, I mean, if I think about the big takeaways in macro right now, most important thing in my mind is the dollar. What is happening with the dollar? It doesn't mean that you can predict. I think in the long run, I'm willing to make the prediction that it loses its hegemony over the financial system. Does that mean that it depreciates like Mark and Luke think it will? Or does it mean that it appreciates for the reason that Jeff thinks it would appreciate? Or does it only appreciate for the reason that I described that it might appreciate? I don't know. Those are all possibilities. What I'll be doing is watching the tape to tell me what the dollar is doing, because only the market knows what is going to happen. I don't have a crystal ball, but I will be able to interpret whatever moves that I see in a framework of understanding based on focusing on this that most people don't have. Next key takeaway after the dollar is probably inflation. Next one after that is sovereign bond yields. Where are treasuries headed? Are we going to stay stuck in a Japan-like low interest rate environment for the next 20 years, or are we going to see the Jeff Gundlach scenario play out? I can't make any prediction about either one of those. What I can do is understand and study both of them so that as either one of them starts to play out in the market, I know how to interpret it. I know how to make sense of it.
Well, you know, when you're talking about the bond markets like that, and, you know, one of the things that I got a couple times mentioned in the series I picked up on and when you were talking about is this idea that eventually, you know, treasury bonds are going to come out of favor and interest rates will start structurally rising across the board. And that will sort of be one of those, I guess, signposts of where this transition point can occur. But I kind of remind everyone, like, for instance, a lot of people had that perspective toward the Japanese government bonds, the JGBs, right? Short sellers of the JGBs it's been called the big widowmaker trade of the decade, where basically it's bankrupted more people than any other trade, trying to bet that eventually, you know, interest rates will have to go up in Japan. And yet, no matter how much we see, you know, things deteriorating in Japan, it doesn't change the fact that these yields still continue to hover at zero or negative in this period. And I kind of asked the question, well, yeah, eventually treasury bonds will have to come to roost, but I would not be surprised if it had a very similar type of scenario as Japan, where we just stay at no matter, even if we see selling in China and selling in Saudi Arabia of treasury bonds, I just think that generally we're going to see very low yields for a long period of time. Maybe I'll be wrong. We'll find out. But I'm not ready to jump on that bond bearer bandwagon just yet anyway.
Well, I agree with you. And I think the important thing to realize there is, how is it possible for, obviously rates can back up a little bit, but how is it possible for a big move up in treasury yields to historically normal levels, let's say a 7 or 8% yield on the U.S. 10-year? How do you possibly get to there without bankrupting the U.S. government along the way? Because the U.S. government's debt maturity is much shorter than it used to be. And, we're basically just able to service the debt at these interest rates. If you saw a doubling or tripling of interest rates from here, that's a doubling or tripling of the U.S. government's debt service cost, which it cannot afford. And unless there was some really just super profound change in the economy, you know, somebody invents cold fusion and all of a sudden energy is free, or there's some other profound technological advancement that is just a huge boom for society somehow. Short of that, I think you're stuck in an environment where, as until the debt gets resolved, it's impossible to go, and this is basically Lacey Hunt's argument, you've got so much debt that it's impossible to get back to anything resembling what we historically think of as normal interest rates, because if you got to that point, we couldn't possibly service all of the debt.
Let me put some context to some of your numbers. If you look at the total credit stock in the U.S. debt, it's about $69 trillion, of which almost $21 trillion of that is U.S. national debt. Right now, today, the calculation is the total amount of interest paid on that $69 trillion of credit stock is about $2.6 trillion. But now I want to rewind the clock and go back to 2008, you know, just when Obama was coming into office. The credit stock of debt was about $49 trillion, about, you know, a solid $20 trillion less. But how much interest did it take to service $49 trillion? It was $4 trillion. In other words, we have seen, even though the debt has increased by $20 trillion, we've seen about, you know, $1.4 trillion less of interest payments to maintain it, right? And so if you had a scenario where we just went back to the same interest rates as 2008, obviously there's going to be a lag because a lot of debt is locked into fixed rates. And so it's not fully sensitive. But over time, if we normalize that way, we would be talking about, you know, $5 trillion a year in interest payments to service that debt. I mean, it's just not to me, a fathomable number without there being unintended consequences that, you know, we talk about in that show.
Well, and I think history is really important as a guiding light here, because look at history and try to find an example of a large developed society that gets itself over indebted, which we clearly are, and you know, has an aha moment and says, oh boy, we've screwed up. We need to pay our way out of this debt in order to solve our financial problems. And so they do that. They invoke austerity or they do whatever, and it all gets better. As far as I know, that has never, ever happened in recorded history, ever. Now, you do have situations where there are small countries that have austerity imposed on them by their creditors. You owe us money, you're going to pay it back, or we're going to send the Marines in to invade you. You know, you have that kind of stuff that goes on. But as far as a country voluntarily saying, boy, we've been very irresponsible for the last 30 or 40 years. We've gotten ourselves into more debt than our children and our grandchildren can possibly afford to service. Let's start being responsible and spend a lot of our energy in society working to pay down that debt, to pave the way for a brighter future for tomorrow. That has never, ever happened. Human nature just doesn't work that way. What happens is you either have a debt jubilee that it gets written off in, or there's a war and the loser of the wars, you know, defaults on their debt, or some kind of restructuring or something. I don't believe that there's any example in human history of an over-indebted nation voluntarily deciding to just get its act together. So, you know, what's the way out of this? And the thing is, where I think it comes to a head is in the next several years, in the next 10 years, we're going to get to the point where all these unfunded liabilities, the pension system, the Social Security system going broke, when the social promises that have been made to people are broken, which they will be, and they have to be, because there's no money to support them. When we find out that they have to means test Social Security, and there are people that worked their whole lives, thought they were going to count on Social Security, and it turns out you don't get anything, there's going to be some massive political lashback. And probably that's the point where you get a, you know, I think probably the best one-line comment that I heard in this entire series was Jeff Snyder's line when he said, look, some people like Donald Trump, some people don't like Donald Trump, but I'll tell you something, if you don't like Donald Trump, wait till you see the next guy. And I think that that's this environment we're in, and a fourth turning, going back to Neil Howe's work, is what people do in fourth turnings is they get so frustrated losing faith in institutions that they look for extreme leaders. Donald Trump is definitely an extreme. You can't argue that point. Bernie Sanders would be a very different extreme, but also an extreme. And as this situation gets worse, people are going to look for more and more extreme solutions. And maybe after Donald Trump, the next guy is in the opposite political orientation. It's more of a Bernie Sanders or even a more socialist version of that, who says we're going to just write off all of the debt and start on a clean slate and default on everything. And of course, you know, that doesn't make sense. It means a whole bunch of institutions go broke. It leads to all kinds of problems. But I think things that we consider unthinkable will become thinkable before this is over. And I think that the ultimate resolution, the catalyst that brings it on, will be when the government is unable to service its social obligations, when pensions entitlements are going broke, people are not getting their benefits, healthcare is breaking down. That's when you get to a point where the social upheaval either leads to a war or it leads to a radical change where things get written off and there's a reset, a debt jubilee, something that completely resets the system.
You know, Eric, I've talked to you about this stuff for well over a year back and forth, but having done this series with these really smart guys, did you find that your view has changed in any way? I mean, I look at this as almost like a critical thinking exercise where you had an opportunity to test your ideas against other smart people. Has anything changed in your view in the bigger picture?
Well, as I said earlier, the really big change for me is I think this is too complicated to try to figure out an answer. I don't try anymore to have an opinion on U.S. dollar bullish or bearish. What I try to do is educate myself as much as I possibly can about both cases. So as it starts playing out in the market and the market tells me which way it's going, I can make sense of why it's happening and what I should expect in terms of knock-on effects and consequences. But on that note, we are out of time. Folks, we really hope that you enjoyed this series. We tremendously appreciate the donations that we've received from so many of you. They are allowing us both to pay for what we've already done, but also to plan even more exciting content for the coming year. We do need your help, though, promoting the show. Please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices. Forward your research roundup emails. Retweet us. Do anything that you can, because the more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, that's the statistic that Patrick uses to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of download links to all of the coolest stuff that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads from our feature interviews, as evidenced by the three fantastic slide decks that you had in this series. Patrick, tell them what else they can find in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, you'll find the final transcript for this episode of the series, so you could go back and reread some of the best parts. You'll also find the link to the slide decks that our guests used during the interview. There's also a link from Jeffrey Snyder with a new article titled "The Anti-Reflation Story is the One That Mattered and the Treasury Market Isn't the Only One Telling It." And there's also a link to a great article and podcast series on Mishtalk interviewing Lacey Hunt on the unintended consequences of the Federal Reserve policies. I thought it was really good, some of the points that he makes out in there. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.